All right, so my subject for the message today is the book of John. I'm not sure. I may have quite a few verses today. I don't know if it's a valid or a complaint to say, you know, that message was good, but there was just too much Bible in that sermon or split sermon. I don't know. You might want to try that, but I don't know if I recommend it. But if I have too many verses, I'm going to make it a little bit easy and offset that a little bit, because we're going to stay in the book of John for the whole time. The book of John is a very interesting book, especially at this time of year before the Passover season. It was likely one of the last books of the New Testament written, probably the last of the four Gospels, and maybe even later than most other books, not including Revelation or the 1st through 3rd John. It covers such a wide range of events. Certainly it covers all the way through Christ's ascension into heaven, but it starts from the very beginning, maybe even earlier than the book of Genesis. Of course, the book of John is well known for a couple things. It's well known for seven miracles that are described, starting with the water, turning the water into wine, and through the resurrection of Lazarus. But really, if you look at it, there's way more miracles than just seven. Those are the seven big ones, but there are just so many miracles that happen throughout the book that are recorded in the book of John. It's also known for the seven I Ams, very important thing, and I'll actually cover those briefly in the few minutes coming up ahead. But even with the seven I Ams, there's a few more than seven I Ams, if you actually look at that. And again, we'll kind of briefly cover that. You know, and certainly it's an important book. I mentioned this already, but for the Passover season, right, and specifically the Passover service, we cover quite a bit of the book of John during that service. So it's an important text as part of our Passover service. Also interesting in the book, I don't know if you've ever thought about it this way, but there's a lot of one-on-one discussions between Jesus and another person, you know, between Jesus and Nicodemus, between Jesus and the Samaritan woman, and others as well. It's part of my job. I have one-on-ones. I have a one-on-one weekly with my boss. I have one-on-ones with my team members weekly or bi-weekly. But it's an interesting thing that these people had this one-on-one dialogue with the Son of God. What an incredible thing. And these are recorded for us to read. We don't get to experience them as being part of that, but at least we can read these, and it's covered in the book of John. Another interesting fact I just kind of looked at this morning is that, just kind of scribbled this into my notes, the book of John is sort of like a mini Bible, and the reason I say that is because it starts in the beginning, just like Genesis does, which I knew that, but then I was like, what's the last word of the book of John? Anyone know what's the last word? It's amen, just like Revelation in. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Just a little interesting fact. Also about the book, the last kind of factoid, I guess, but it's one book that clearly states the purpose of why it was written, and we'll cover that verse. And maybe there's even two verses that are kind of stating, this is why I wrote the book. And we'll cover that later on here in this message. Anyway, for this message, what I want to really focus on is some themes that kind of stood out to me. Mr. Gore challenged, I don't know if a challenge is the right word, but he suggested that, you know, for Passover preparation, reading through the book of John was a good thing. So I took that on mainly last week, and as I was reading through them, there were a number of things that really stood out to me, and so I started capturing those in some notes and used that as the basis in the beginning of the preparation for this message. So what I want to do today is specifically cover some themes that stood out to me in the book of John. And I think these are themes that, you know, you could use, or that we could use in preparation for the Passover, and specifically around the examination part. We could choose, if you don't have other things you're working on, this might be a help to think, I should examine myself with respect to, you know, one of these themes that we're going to go through. So that's my intent and purpose in the message today. So we're going to start with the first theme is humility. So I think humility, especially at the beginning of the book, stood out to me in this book of John. And particularly the humility of two of the central characters. Certainly Jesus is the central character throughout the book. But early in the book, John the Baptist plays a very important role, and a lot of what he did is recorded, and some of what he said is recorded. So that's where we're going to start, by looking at the example that they both of them set with respect to humility. Now, if you think about these two people from a human perspective, they were famous people. I mean, they had followers. I mean, people were coming out to see them. Some of the top leaders were either going to see them and question them, or they were sending their people to question them. You know, they could have looked around and said, wow, look at me. All these people are here. I'm somebody important. And thinking about John the Baptist, he was kind of the lead guy. Well, up until his cousin, who's 6 months younger, kind of comes along. How did John think about this? Did he think, wow, I'm going to lose my followers? Well, we're going to look at that. So let's start by reading a couple verses. So we'll start in John chapter 14, verse 28. So this shows a little bit about Christ's humility. Again, in human terms, Jesus was something. He was something on earth. He had followers. He had people coming to talk to him. He was a great speaker. I mean, he left people in awe when he spoke. But what was his attitude? John 14, verse 28 says, "You have heard me say to you, I am going away and coming back to you. If you love me, you would rejoice because I am going to my Father." And this is the part I want to emphasize at the very end of this verse. "For my Father is greater than I." Jesus knew his place. He knew what his place was. He knew he was below the Father, and he was happy. And he accepted that, and he lived his life knowing that. The whole life of Jesus was a practice in humility. I mean, he chose to leave his throne, the amazing place that he was, and come to earth and become, well, a little bit like one of us. What a humbling act that was. Certainly the trial, his crucifixion, was a humbling act. These people that were doing this to him had no authority that wasn't given to him. He could have stopped it at any point in time, but he allowed that to happen. He allowed very awful things. He allowed people to say horrible things, people that were, in many terms, terrible, terrible people, but he allowed that because he was humble, and he knew what he had to do. Certainly the Passover service, we're going to experience that coming up soon. He showed humility in that. I even was thinking a little bit about the temptation. When he was tempted by Satan, you know, that was, to me, potentially an act of humility, because Satan was nothing. I mean, Jesus knew Satan. He looked at him as a just disgusting being. And Jesus, because he knew it was something that needed to be done, he allowed Satan to drag him around from place to place and question him and challenge him. Satan had no business doing that. But Jesus allowed it to happen. I think it's an incredible act of humility that we can consider. Now, John the Baptist. Again, John the Baptist had a following. People were coming to see him. But what was his attitude? Especially, like I mentioned, when this younger guy was coming up and taking, you know, potentially taking his followers away from him. There was even a little bit of dispute, I think, back and forth between maybe some of the followers. And what was John's reaction? So we'll look at a couple verses here. So John 1, if you want to flip back to the beginning of the book, we'll read 1 in verse 27. John knew his place. You know, Christ knew his place. Jesus knew he was the Son of God. He needed to do God's will. John the Baptist also knew his place. Verse 27 in chapter 1 says, "It is he who, coming after me, is preferred before me, whose sandal strap I am not worthy to loose." Worthy to loose, sorry. I mean, John knew he was nothing compared to Jesus. But again, in human terms, maybe at that time, John might have had more followers. Jesus was just starting out. John seemed to have already been preaching and having followers, doing the baptizing. But he still knew his place. He knew that he was nothing in comparison to Jesus. Let's read chapter 3, turn over a page or so to verse 30. To me, this is one of the coolest, very short, very concise, but one of the coolest verses in the Bible. And I think it's worth meditating and thinking about. John 3, verse 30 says, John speaking, referring to Jesus, says, "He must increase, I must decrease." What an incredible thing to think about. You know, we often think about, you know, in terms of business, or we're always raising the bar, right? We're always trying to get better and raising the bar. But when it comes to humility, we want to be continually lowering the bar and putting ourselves lower, just the way John says, "I must decrease." As we decrease ourselves and we allow God to increase in our life, that is such a wonderful opportunity for us. When we let God increase us, he can do so much for us than we could ever do. In human terms, there have been people who have been amazing. They have put aside humility and used pride, and they've gained a lot through that. But that's going to be nothing. That's going to be nothing to what God will do when it's time for him to raise us up. So humility, you know, again, to me, that's an important key, and it's something that I think about quite a bit. I'm not any good at it, but I know I need to get better, I think. You know, at some point, I want to be the best person in the world at humility. But actually, in my job, I get frustrated at times, and somebody's presenting an idea, and I'm like, I'm sitting in a meeting, and we're virtual, so cameras are not off, so I can do this. Nobody knows, but there's a funny video I saw, but sorry, I don't want to distract myself, but it's about returning to the office, and they're in person, having a live meeting, and the guy's sitting there, one guy's talking, the manager, and the guy is sitting there, and he's making all these weird faces, and he's like, "Oh, I forgot, we're in the room together." But anyway, I'm like, this is exactly the opposite of what we should be doing. And I start to trying to prove that this is wrong, and I get a combative, and I start to shut down a little bit. And then I even if it's a bad idea, I almost make the situation worse. And what I'm trying to work on is like, okay, let the bad ideas go by, focus on the good, figure out what we need to do to work together. Think about this. Somebody could come and criticize you. How do you take that criticism? Let's think about somebody comes to you and says something, and they're 99% wrong, but they're 1% right. Is your reaction to focus on the 99% and prove that, no, I'm okay, I did the right thing? But are you missing an opportunity for that 1% of growth? Or think about the criticism that they're 100% right, but they present it in an awful way. You know, they yell at you something, or they just say it in a sarcastic manner. One of my daughters, or maybe it's all three of them, their violin teacher, one of their violin teachers said something just seemed really absurd in criticism of the class. How do you take that? Do you focus on, well, that was just a dumb, you know, that was a terrible way to deliver that. I'm not even going to listen to you. Certainly we shouldn't be taking, you know, at some point we shouldn't be allowing ourselves to be abused, but if you're humble, do you say, well, that was a terrible way to approach that, but yeah, maybe I am doing something wrong. That's an example of humility. So again, the more humble we are, the more opportunity we have to grow and improve ourselves. So again, in preparing for the Passover, this is a theme that you might want to consider. How humble am I? What can I do to become more humble? And what are the benefits of humility? All right, the second theme I want to jump into, it's light versus dark. So when I see this book of John, there's some talk, at least, about light and dark. And I think this is a theme that, again, can be helpful for us. So let's look at chapter 1 and verse 4. John 1 and verse 4. It starts to set the stage of light and dark that comes out in a number of verses in the book of John. 1 verse 4 says, "In him," referring to Jesus or the Word, was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. What a powerful verse this is. So let's think about this for a little bit. You know, first of all, the world is in darkness. We need to acknowledge that. We need to know that. We need to know that we're starting from a point of darkness. We need to understand that. We need to understand that as we're working on our conversion, there are parts of our life maybe that are still having that bits of darkness. And then we can also see from this verse that where does the light come from? You know, the true light comes from God, comes from the Son of God. And of course, there's this reaction, dark does not understand light. So I think when we understand these three things about this verse, we can start to understand what we need to do different. And the light versus dark is such a great analogy to understand the stark contrast. You know, we could obviously see a light room versus a dark room. It's clear, right? They're so different. So we need to understand that, you know, the world's way, our human nature way, and God's way are so different. And we need to be moving out of the darkness into the light. Let's look at chapter 3, and we'll read verse 19 through 21, continuing on this theme of light versus dark. 3 verse 19 says, "And this is the condemnation, that the light has come into the world, and men love darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil. And for everyone practicing evil hates the light, it does not come to the light, lest the deeds should be exposed. But he who does the truth comes to the light, and that his deeds may be clearly seen, as they have been done by God." So this is our challenge, right? Our challenge is that we are starting from a point of darkness. We're living in a world that is dark, and there's this reaction of wanting to stay in the dark. But this is part of our overcoming. We need to recognize that the light comes from God and that we need to move into that light. You know, I was kind of thinking about this also, that it's not a one-time change. It's a lifetime of change, right? It's something that we got to continually be working on. I was thinking about rooms in a house and our life. So you walk into your house and you walk in, maybe the first room is an office. Okay, that's my life at church and among church people. And then you go around and you go into the living room. That's my life at work, you know, around work people. You walk to the kitchen. Well, that's my life with my immediate family. Maybe in the dining room. That's my life with my friends, maybe people I grew up with or something. You go upstairs. You know, this is my life. With extended family. And you go in the back closet of that room, and that's your life when the referee makes a bad call and your favorite team loses the game, right? You know, there's another, you know, the small bathroom upstairs, you know, that maybe that's the room that's your life when somebody criticizes you and you didn't deserve it. So now you think about all these rooms, different parts of your life. How much is the light shining in each of these rooms? Certainly in the room, the first room I mentioned here at church, our light is shining bright. And I hope it's shining bright in all the rooms. But as you think about this, think about all parts of your life. How much is the light shining in all areas? Traffic, I didn't mention. I could have mentioned that. That's another dark closet. Somebody cuts you off in traffic. How much light is shining in your life at that point? I'll carry this slightly further. Also, light switches. There's two kinds of light switches. Well, there's probably more. There's probably three-way switches. We won't go there. But a light switch can be on-off, but it can be more of also a dimmer, right? Maybe some of you have dimmer switches. I think that's another way to look at the light versus dark. You know, this is not just click and you're fully bright. I think, you know, in our life, in our challenge, in our conversion, we need to think about this. We're turning the light on. And every year, we need to be turning more light on in each of these rooms of our house. So again, as part of preparing for the Passover, this could be a theme that you would want to look into and think about. Are you putting the darkness away, and are you bringing more light into your life? The next theme that I want to cover is around, and I think this is something that's incredible that I still struggle to comprehend, But Jesus talks about what is real versus what is not real. And he teaches these lessons. And it's one of the most mind-blowing things that he does when he's interacting with his disciples or with Nicodemus. You know, just for an example, you know, it starts by saying, you know, if you want to keep your life, if you want life, what did Jesus say to do? Lose it. That doesn't make any sense, right? Seemingly. We have to give up our life to have life. That's what's real. We start to understand, and we're taught in this book of John, what is real. So Jesus used a couple of very physical things to kind of compare and contrast what is real versus what is really real. And he used that with birth, being born, and with food. So let's look at that. So let's look at John 3, verses 5. 3, verse 5, I think, you know. John 3, 5. So this is, you know, this is where Jesus is talking to Nicodemus. And Nicodemus's mind is kind of blown. He doesn't know what to, he's like, what in the world? So Jesus says, most assuredly, I say to you, unless one is born of water and of spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of God. And verse 6, we'll continue there. That which is born of flesh is flesh, and that which is born of spirit is spirit. You know, it took a long time for Nicodemus to really understand this. I'm sure he took this conversation to heart and thought about it over and over and over so that he could really understand this. What does this mean? A couple chapters later, the next chapter, Jesus is talking to the Samaritan woman, and he's telling her that he has the water that you need to live, and she's in the physical world. You know, these people are starting from the physical world. We start from the physical, right? She's like, well, where's your bucket? How are you getting me some water out of this well? You don't have a pitcher or anything to draw the water with. She's confused. Let's read chapter 4, verse 32 through 34 to continue to understand that when Jesus was dealing with people, they were starting from the physical, but he was moving them to what was real. 4:32 says, but then he said to them, the disciples, I have food to eat, which you do not know. Therefore the disciples said to one another, has anyone brought him anything to eat? Jesus said to them, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. The disciples were like thinking in the physical terms, and they had to learn to think in the spiritual, which they did, well, all except Judas. They learned that, but it took them a while to figure this out. They didn't immediately get it. I mean, they had the best teacher in the world, and they didn't get it for a while. Actually, a little bit feel bad for the disciples. I mean, they must have spent the 3.5 years with Jesus. They must have been shaking their heads so many times. We hear some of the discussions like this one that's recorded for us, but how often were they like, do you understand that? I don't understand that. Do you? You ask him what it means. It was kind of tough, it seems like, for them. Chapter 6 continues on this theme of showing food and what is real and what is not. We need food. We all have to eat. So there is some real part of that. But Jesus uses this as to say, this is temporary. This is not lasting. What you need is the bread of life, and I am that bread of life. He talked to them about manna. I mean, manna was such an incredible thing. It was a blessing directly from God for the ancient Israelites, and they ate of it. But what happened to them? They all died. They all died, and besides maybe, you know, a handful of people, Moses, Aaron, Miriam, Joshua, Caleb, the rest of them, they have nothing to show for what they did in their lives. They're going to have their chance later. But that manna didn't do anything for them. Christ starts to talk about that and trying to explain what's important. What do we need to be working towards? So let's read two verses out of chapter 6. We'll start with verse 35. Here it says, and Jesus said to them, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst. And then drop down to verse 53. Then Jesus said to them, Most assuredly, I say to you, unless you eat of the flesh of the Son of Man and drink of his blood, you have no life in you. Now, of course, this is talking about the Passover, but those are just symbols, right? But what Jesus is saying is, come to me for everything you need. Come to me for the food. Come to me for the water. I have what you need. I have what is going to give you everlasting life. So again, as you are thinking about examining yourself, you might want to consider in your life, are you focusing, you know, are we focusing on what is real? Are we spending our time, you know, putting our treasure in heaven versus on earth? This could be something that is helpful for you. The next thing I want to talk about, and that we learn so much, I think we learn more about this subject in the book of John than anywhere else in the Bible. We learn about God's family. You know, when we look at the Old Testament, we consider, you know, the parallel to John 1:1 is Genesis 1:1. There we get a hint that says, let us make, you know, et cetera, you know, the whole creation. Well, what is the us? Throughout the Old Testament, you don't really get too many insights. I think there's one verse in Psalms that when we read that in the context of knowing what we know about the New Testament, we can say, oh, yeah, I understand that. But for people who did not have the New Testament to read, who did not have the teaching of Jesus, it's kind of tough to look at the Old Testament. And John, again, is a book that really gives us a lot of insights about the family of God. It talks a lot about Jesus and his role. Let's look at, I'm going to skip a few things to try to stay on time here. You know, the people, as they were interacting with Jesus, they started to understand who he was. They got little glimpses into who he was, and they started to realize that he was not just a man. Let's look at 8 and verse 58, chapter 8, verse 58. This, again, is one of the, to me, one of the most powerful verses in the Bible. And the people that heard this, maybe they didn't fully comprehend it, but they knew what Jesus meant when he said what he said that's recorded in verse 58. And they didn't like it, mostly. Jesus said to them, most assuredly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. You know, Jesus was directly telling him, I am a God. I am part of the God family. And he goes on many, many other places where he describes very clearly that he is the Son of God. So we can understand that there in the God family is the Son of God and that Jesus was manifested as a man, but he was the Son of God. We also start to get some insights about God the Father in the book of John. You know, Jesus came and helped to reveal God the Father. Again, looking at the Old Testament only, it's hard to see that. Let's look at chapter 1 and verse 18. So we start to understand the God family as John records and as we're being taught through the book of John. Verse 118 says, no one has ever seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father, has declared him. So he's saying that there is a God the Father, but who is he? What is he like? Well, let's flip over to chapter 14 and read 14, 7 through 11. John 14, verse 7 through 11. And we'll start to learn who is this God the Father and what is he like. So here Jesus is having some dialogue, specifically with Philip at this case. And verse 7 said, if you had known me, you would have known my Father also, and from now on you know him and have seen him. So here Jesus is saying, you know God the Father. You know him. Philip goes on and is like, I'm not quite, you know, Philip hasn't quite got there yet. Verse 8, Philip said to him, Lord, show us the Father, and it is sufficient to us. And Jesus said to him, have I been with you so long, and yet you have not known me, Philip? He who has sent me has seen the Father. So how can you say, show us the Father? Do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father in me? The words that I speak to you, I do not speak of my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me, it does the work. In verse 11, believe me that I am in the Father and the Father in me, or else believe me for the sake of the works themselves. So here we see that we can know the God the Father by knowing Jesus. We can read the words of Jesus, we can see his example, and we know what God the Father is like. And that's what he was telling his disciples at that time, and that's still true for us. So again, in John, we start to learn about God, the God family. We learn about Jesus. We learn he's the Son of God. We learn about God the Father. We can also see our part in the family of God and the expansion plans. Let's look at two verses in chapter 17. This is the exciting part. I mean, knowing there's God the Father, knowing the Son is so reassuring and awesome. But what's in it for us? What's in it for us? So chapter 17, verse 26. I have declared to them your name. So Jesus here is praying, and he says, I have declared to them your name and declare it, that the love with which you love me may be in them and I in them. And then actually I want to back up to verse 21. Let's back up a little bit to verse 21. We can start to see our role. We are going to be connected very closely with Jesus, the Son of God, and God the Father. Verse 21 says, Jesus prays, in this verse, he prayed for everyone to be like him, to be one in him. You know, Jesus has shown them who the Father was, and he tells them, I and the Father are one, and these disciples are one with me and with you. So we can start to see that our destiny is to be part of the God family and to be one with the Son of God and to be one with the Father. So again, this is something that we can consider and think about with respect to examining ourselves. If our destiny is to be part of the God family, what does that mean? How should we be acting? What should our actions be? What should our attitudes be? What should our thoughts be? What does it take to be in the family of God? Am I doing the things that I need to be doing? Am I acting now like a member of the family of God? Sometimes, hopefully most of the time, ideally all of the time. But again, this might be something that we consider in examining ourselves. How do we compare what we're doing to what a family member of God needs to be doing? All right, so this split sermon, I just wanted to, I've had no points. This is not a five-point sermon, a split sermon. You're probably thinking, I've been sitting here for 30 minutes, I haven't heard a single point yet. I have five themes, not 5 points, five themes. So the last one that I want to cover is believe. I think this is something that stands out so much in the book of John. It's just incredible. So I mentioned at the beginning that the book of John writes, here he tells us, why did I write this verse? Why did I write this book? There's two verses that he explains this. And one of them is chapter 19 and verse 35. And there are many benefits that we can get out of reading the book of John. But here in this verse, John says, this is why I wrote this book. 19 verse 35, it says, and he who has seen has testified, and his testimony is true, and he knows that is telling the truth, so that you may believe. John is saying, I saw all of this happening. I'm writing it down. It is true, and I'm doing this so that you may believe. Why do we want to believe? I think that's an obvious answer, but let's just make sure. And look at John 3, verse 36. It states very clearly why we need to believe. John 3, verse 36. Here it says, he who believes in the Son has everlasting life, and he who does not believe the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God abides on him. So, anyone want everlasting life? I think that's why we're here. This is one way that we need to think about it, that we need to believe in order for us to have everlasting life. As I was preparing this message, I had most of my notes in the verses that I wanted to put together. One thing I was kind of thinking about, like, this word believe, it just kept coming up over and over in the book. So I was just curious. So I did a search. I use BibleGateway.com mostly as an online Bible source. And so I just typed believe and clicked the search button. And it shows up 86 times in the book of John, which it's 21 chapters in John. That's on average four times per chapter the word believe. So I have to believe that belief is a central theme of the book. It's incredible. And it just statistically, you know, it's a statistical relevant number, I'll say that, because of the whole Bible, believe is used 270 times. So over 30% of the times that word is used is in the book of John. So we can learn a lot about believing, knowing that we need to believe, and helping to understand how that we are to believe. And we had to consider that there's levels of belief. You know, as the disciples, whether it was the chosen ones, the 11 and 12, but really focusing on the 11, you know, they believed for a while, and then many other followers believed for a while. But what was their level of belief? It was something that was not just, I believe, and they were perfect from that point on. Some of them believed, but they still liked their life. Like, I believe you're the Son of God, but I want to be part of the temple still, so I'm not going to admit it to anyone. And there were times where, like, yes, I believe, I'm going to follow. But then things got hard. Like when Jesus said, I am the bread of life, you need to eat me, basically. They're like, whoa, that's too much. And they stopped following him. Even the disciples, when times got tough, they stopped following, at least temporarily, at least maybe all but one of them. You know, certainly Peter's story is very famous. But this belief is not something that just happens. It takes work over time. There are some things that are recorded in John that I think are really interesting. They're very interesting about this belief. Let's look at a couple verses here. So John chapter 2 and verse 22. Again, complete belief takes time. I mean, you would think that as a disciple who was with Christ almost every day for 3.5 years, you would think that they understood and they believed. But for them, it was a process. It took a while. Again, we think about the story of Peter. You know, he fell away a little bit, but, you know, he came back. He came back stronger than ever, and his belief was to the point that he allowed a horrible death to take his life to end with a horrible death because of his strong beliefs. 2 and verse 22, it says, therefore, when he had risen from the dead, the disciples remembered that he had said to them, and they believed the scripture and the word that Jesus said. So the wording in this is very interesting, because they were there witnessing. Jesus was teaching them, talking to them, and yet it took a while for them. They had to actually see some of these events happen before they fully believed and before they fully understood what was going on. Let's look at chapter 20 and verse 8. Chapter 20 and verse 8. Again, this is hard for me to reflect back on and think about what was it like to be that disciple or those disciples. You know, we have the whole New Testament that we can read. I mean, for my whole life, I mean, I probably started attending, of course, with my parents, but I was around 5 years old. There's never a time in my life that I don't remember believing that, yes, Jesus is the Son of God. This man who was alive on earth 2,000 years ago was the Son of God. He was sacrificed. He was resurrected. There was never a time that I didn't understand that. But I don't compare myself and say, well, I'm better off than some of these disciples because they didn't get it. We're going to see in this verse. But there's these levels of belief, and I think our understanding of belief is this really deep, deep thing that we need to consider. Verse 8 in chapter 20, it says, then the other disciple who came into the tomb first also went in, and he saw and he believed. So he had to go into the tomb before he believed. Verse 9 says, for as yet they did not know the scripture that he must rise again from the dead. That's just hard in a way for me to think about what it was like for them. Verse 29, let's read that one. You know, this is where this is our opportunity. Because we're not there physically. This is our opportunity. Let's see what Jesus offers to us who are not physically there when he was a person on earth. Jesus said to him, "Thomas, because you have seen me and you have not believed, blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. You know, we have this opportunity to not see and yet believe. But again, I think that, at least for me, you know, belief is, there's these levels of belief. Again, for me, it's easy for me to accept that Christ was resurrected and that he's the Son of God. But do I believe enough? Do I believe strongly enough to change my life? You know, am I believing strongly enough to do the things that I need to do to be part of and to have everlasting life? So again, as we're preparing for Passover, this might be a theme to consider, something to meditate on, maybe study into, is what is our level of belief? Is our belief been growing over the past year? Are we getting stronger in our beliefs? Is our faith growing? So those are the five themes, the five suggestions. I'll offer them as suggestions. You know, again, as we want to prepare and examine ourselves before the Passover, consider thinking about these things. Think about humility. Are we growing in humility from one year to the next? Is there an opportunity for us to become more humble? Think about living in the light and putting darkness out of our life. How are we doing in that? Are there some opportunities for us to get better? Are we understanding what is real versus what is the physical? You know, our lives are kind of important to us. I mean, you know, it's pretty important that I will wake up tomorrow morning and have a day. But our lives are going to be like, you know, our physical lives are going to be like this long, you know, compared to however eternity is. The decisions, the hurts, the pains, the suffering, the hard choices that we need to make in this part of our existence versus what we have to look forward to, it's not even comparable. So think about what is real and what is not real. Consider the family of God, and that what is our part in that family. We have the opportunity. How are we doing as a child of God? Are we living up to the expectations of being part of the God family? And then finally, think about our depth of belief. How deep, how strong is our belief? So let's close with one last verse. I think it's another very cool verse. It talks, kind of sums up the book of John and how this book can be helpful to us, certainly during the Passover season, but throughout the whole year. Chapter 20, verse 31. John 20, verse 31. "But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." What a wonderful thing.